This week on Writers, Inc.
But I do stumble across things in my work as a journalist and as an essayist that I think do help me understand the sort of fundamental questions that also drive every good novel, which is, who are we to each other? Why do we do this to each other? Why do we treat each other the way we do?
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So do I look like I put on like 100 pounds to you guys, like right now?
No, absolutely.
No. No. I wasn't going to say anything, J.D., but
I was walking by. My daughter likes to play this game. Like, she stands on the back of the couch and like she will jump into my arms.
Okay.
And like I was walking by the couch yesterday and she's like, "Hey dad, a catch," and like took me totally by surprise. And like I kind of caught her sideways, like instead of being straight on, I was like standing the wrong way. And like, you know, this was a fun game when she weighed like 40 pounds, but now she's 75 pounds. So like I grabbed her but I tweaked something in my back. So like I'm wearing a back brace underneath my shirt, which has me sitting up with super good posture. So the moral of the story is don't catch a 75-pound kid when they jump at you. Just let them hit the ground.
That's, got it.
That's noted.
Probably, that's
they
probably
bounce
better.
Anyway.
Way ahead of you.
So I was trying to remember if I talked about this on the air or not, but this is I've got like an Amazon horror story. You know, so I've got this new book coming out. It's a prequel to my existing trilogy. So it's technically book four. You know, there's three books already out. But Amazon gave me the hardest time about coding it as book four in the series for a bunch of different reasons. Like the first two books in the series are put out by HarperCollins. You know, the third one was done through my own press. This one's coming out through Simon & Schuster. So like they initially pushed back saying I didn't even have the right to attach it to the series. So I had to get over that hurdle. And then once I got past that hurdle, then they coded it as related to the original trilogy, but they wouldn't code it as book four. And then I every time you email them, like you get a different person to reply. So you're never talking to like the same person.
Yeah.
So I explained everything, hoped that they would understand. They came back and like they said, well, it says prequel on the cover. You have prequel in your description. We can't put it after the original trilogy. So it's got to go before. And like they don't have a way to code a before. I think some of the sites do, like you can code like earlier stuff, but like, they don't. So after like, I mean, I must have 50 to 100 emails back and forth with different people at Amazon. I finally got them. I had to change the cover, like take the word prequel, because I think I had a Forum K thriller prequel or something like that on the cover. So I had to take that word off of it. And then I finally got somebody who was willing to code it as book four in my series. Like that was the part that killed me. Like they wouldn't let me attach it to my own series, you know, even though like I'm clearly the author, I'm clearly the publisher, you know, like I've got all the rights, but like they just, you know, whatever checklist they're working on, like they were not willing to cooperate.
Yikes.
So that was fun. So yeah. I guess none of you have ever run into that, right? Like Kevin, you're the only one with a series out there, right?
I spent 2 weeks on the of emails with Amazon when I was writing the sci-fi adventure, and I can't remember what it was for, but it was like a really easy question. And it took me 2 weeks to get an answer. So I forget exactly what it was. Yeah.
The closest I've come to what you're dealing with is I have a series of shorter books, like novellas and short stories that are related to the Kotler books. And they keep trying to make them the next Kotler book. So I keep having to go in and move it back into a different, I had to create a whole new series basically to do that. So it's sort of the opposite of what you're doing.
I thought about doing that, and like the way that I wrote these, you could read the prequels first and then read the original trilogy, and it still works, but it gives away some of the spoilers and things like that. So like if you really want to experience it the right way, you have to read the original trilogy, you know, which is just it's very confusing, and I get it. But like they shouldn't, like if the author and the publisher are telling them to do something, like they shouldn't question it or not do it for something that
I agree.
Simple. So I'm going to write a strongly worded letter to whoever took over for Jeff Bezos.
And go there.
All right, Kevin, what is in the news?
All right. So what I learned about American men in my all-male book club. This sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. A writer started an all-male book club with friends and neighbors, discovering many men already read widely, but usually do so privately and rarely talk about books socially. While data shows men read fiction less than women, the gap may be overstated. Overall reading is declining for everyone, not just men. The author argues that male book clubs can help normalize reading for men, giving them a social space to discuss books and encouraging them to read more. I actually don't know a single man in my life that doesn't read fiction. So,
oh, you must know some, like a closed bubble of people.
Well, I don't think guys don't talk about it as much.
They don't talk
as
about it
do.
Is what he was saying in this article. Yeah.
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 But I don't know. It's not as common to find men who read.
Yeah, I think it depends, like, when you surround yourself with people, because, like, maybe because you don't have the corporate job, Kevin. The people I talk to, they do not read. Most of them do not read.
Most of my friends are writers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, I was at the dentist yesterday, and so my dentist, we bonded very quickly over books. And so, you know, we, like, I bring her books, and it's a whole thing. And now they know that we always talk about books on all of my visits. And yeah, like the men in the office are always like, yeah, I don't read, or like, well, I like reading. I just don't really like get into it that much. Or like, it's always the women who are the readers.
That's okay. That's it.
What was really interesting in this article that I was reading, you know, as he was talking about, he tried to join book clubs before, but they were like all women, and he felt like he was encroaching on the female book club experience, which I totally get. And then was just kind of quietly talking and figuring out some friends also read, but he said men like to read about things they wanted to be when they grow up, so like books about pirates and astronauts and knights and that kind of thing, spies. So I thought that was a kind of cool perspective.
Okay, so I figured it out. Here's what's happening.
Yeah.
The second someone tells me that they don't read, they're dead to me. So I don't know anybody.
I see.
I was in New York last week, and like you'd see a lot of guys actually carrying books in New York. But I think we did this story a little while back, but like a lot of guys will use books as a prop to pick up women. You know, so they will carry one in the open, you know, they've got a duffel bag or whatever, but they physically hold the book. So, you know, the women that walk by can see what they're reading. I don't know if that works or not, but
it does work.
I'm sure it does. Yeah.
Does it?
There's a whole funny. Like social media account. I think it's on all the channels now, but it's Hot Guys Reading.
Yeah.
And that's all it is just pictures of men reading books in public places.
Yeah. those people keep taking my picture and pestering me everywhere I go.
Books and dogs work. Like, if you want to talk to a woman and you just are a single dude with no accoutrement, you're much better off with a dog or a book. Like,
Or a book about a dog.
Yeah.
I post up, read my book, My Dog Reads Books, and everybody comes and talks to me.
Wow.
So, all right. Next up, I owe Iron Maiden my English A level. The great literature our writers discovered through pop music. Iron Maiden led one writer to Samuel Taylor College. Their 13-minute song, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, closely retells the famous poem. And one fan said the band essentially helped him ace his English literature exam. The Smiths inspired readers to pick up classic literature. Morrissey's lyric in Cemetery Gates, referencing Oscar Wilde, led one writer to read The Picture of Dorian Gray, along with other novels mentioned in Smith's songs. Nick Cave introduced fans to poet John Berryman in a song criticizing Charles Bukowski. Cave praised Berryman instead, prompting listeners to discover his influential poetry collection, 77 Dream Songs. I read Dorian Gray because of you remember the film League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Yeah.
Which was based on a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. That prompted me to read Dorian Gray, and I ended up really liking Picture of Dorian Gray.
Now, I don't listen to lyrics like when I listen to music. Like, I don't really pick up on the words. It's just more about the melody to me. So, like, this has never happened.
It's happened to me. Well, not, but actually, it was Nick Cave too. I've had red right hand. It's very close to the top of my TBR pile because of Nick Cave. I'm like, oh, I should read that book. That sounds cool. So I'll let you know how red right hand is when I finish. This doesn't happen to you. You don't hear about things in songs and be like, oh, that sounds cool.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I do like it when you kind of realize it, not with song. I mean, it has with songs before, but movies will sometimes do that for me too, when it's like a retelling, but it's like a clever retelling and you didn't know it was a retelling when you went into it. Those are some of my favorites. And then I get curious about the original and kind of start going down those roads, or yeah, the inspiration. But it is pretty cool. Song lyrics, I'm a bit like JD where I hear the melody first. But then a lyric sometimes will stand out, and then I have to go look up the lyrics, and then so I can see this happening.
I mean, definitely lyrics have inspired writing for me. I don't know if that's happened to anyone else.
Like a clever turn of phrase, and you think like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, usually, but it will take me, I usually don't hear the lyrics at first, so it takes me a little while to sort of like, I don't know, you have to like listen to it and then be like, oh.
I'm trying to think if I've, other than Dorian Gray, I'm not sure if I've ever read a book because I discovered it through some other
Medium.
medium. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. All right. So final story. Hungry for affirmation, vulnerable to scams. As a writer, I know the feeling. AI publishing scams have become so pervasive. The New York Times did a story. Some of the highlights: scammers created a convincing lookalike site for the National Book Foundation, complete with fake staff and services. At least one author paid substantial fees for, quote, marketing and proofreading. The real foundation had to issue cease and desist letters and public warnings. Writers receive flattering emails and messages from people impersonating Margaret Atwood and Thomas Pynchon. Major publishers and editors were impersonated, including HarperCollins editors, Simon and Schuster executives, and literary agents, offering marketing help, relicensing, or special opportunities. Some publishers have now set up dedicated fraud inboxes because the volume of impersonation is so high.
I mean, every time when I open my email at this point, like there is literally the 10, 15 of them like right up at the top. And they're always from a Gmail account. You know, it's like, you know they're bogus, but like even my spam filter can't seem to stop them.
No, Gmail accounts are a dead giveaway. My favorite one I saw on Authors Guild, an author put up, it started, "I was sorry to learn of your passing, and then let me market your book." So that's been my favorite one yet. But
That's a good one.
yeah, and Writers Beware also did like a very in-depth article on the Simon and Schuster impersonation, if you want to read more about it. So yeah. You know what news isn't in the news that I saw this morning is that everyone is losing their minds about the new
Akatar?
Court of Thorns and Roses
Yep.
book. And it was like
Oh, yeah.
my favorite part was Bloomsbury has readjusted their profit projections based on this book. So they're like, oh, we're going to make money now. And it was just so interesting to me that one author can influence profit projections like so heavily.
Sarah J. Maas is a big deal.
That was cool.
Yeah, I know. The pre-order will probably break records, I'm sure. Like they're already expecting it.
What number is this in the series?
A
bazillion.
six. So they're releasing October 27th, the sixth one in the series, and then in January they're going to release the seventh one. But she isn't, that series was like kind of like people were expecting it to be closed. Nobody was expecting these books. She's teased it over the last year, but the last one was published in like, what was it, 2020, 2021, somewhere in there. So it's been a while, but yeah, by far that's been like her biggest series. People lose their minds over those books.
You know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year? One that's almost done, but never quite gets there? Well, right now, it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane. And right now, you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book. Start making real progress, escape revision limbo, and publish with confidence story after story. Check out autocrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's autocrit.com/JD.
JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Kat Rosenfeld on. She's a former reporter for MTV News and a current columnist for the Free Press Boston Globe, Vulture, Wired Magazine, many others. When she's not writing for magazines, she's writing novels, including No One Will Miss Her. Her latest title has been described as Wild Meets the Wife Between Us, and it's called How to Survive in the Woods and releases March 10th. Here she is, Kat Rosenfeld.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, we get a lot of writers on listening to our show, along with readers, but we'd like to kind of start at the beginning and go all the way back to your origin story, as it were. How did you get started writing?
Oh, goodness. Okay. So what I usually try to explain to people is that it seemed like everybody else in my life knew that I was going to be a writer before I did. When I was getting married about 17 years ago, my mother got up at the rehearsal dinner and read something that I had written at the age of 9. It was a short story. Some might say a horror story or a thriller. It had, you know, it had all of the elements of the thing. It had God in it. It had marital discord. And it was about a man who wanted to bring, he was the mayor, actually. So there's politics too. A mayor of a town who wanted to bring a motorcycle into his house. And the wife, mayor's wife, said, no, you know, you're not bringing that into my freshly washed rug. And the mayor was so angry that he would stand out on his front lawn, howling at the moon, yelling and screaming. And finally, he yelled so loud that God got mad and, you know, told the wife, we, you know, up in heaven here, like, we can hear this, we don't like it, you're gonna have to just let him bring the motorcycle inside. And and so we did, and that was the end. Oh, and the last line was, and she was never considered a clean woman again. And this was the first story I ever wrote
for a wedding toast.
I have no memory of this. And my mother said, and that was when I knew she was going to be a writer. And everyone said, yep, that tracks. But I didn't know. I didn't know that I was going to be a writer. What ended up happening is in 2003, I graduated from college with a degree in fine art and French, because I thought that I was going to grow up to be a character in a Jane Austen novel, apparently.
Obviously.
Those useless set of skills.
As you would.
As one does. A very well-rounded young lady. And I ended up getting a job in book publishing because I liked to read, and I was a publicist, and I did that job very, very badly for about 2 years. And by that point, I had spent so much time interacting with both journalists and novelists that I understood very, very well that I didn't want to do what I was doing. I wanted to do what they were doing. And I basically pivoted at that point to into freelance writing and said yes to every paid opportunity that came my way. Got a little bit, actually a lot, lucky several times along the way. And 15 years or so later, I turned around and I had managed to scrape together a career.
Wow, that's great. You know, I think what you said, particularly about the, you know, say yes to everything along the way, sometimes doesn't get enough credit, particularly in freelance, and then in the book world, where sometimes those opportunities might not be great on paper, but end up leading to other places. Did you find that you had to sort of make any of those choices, or was it just like, this is what I want to do, so it's yes, yes, yes?
Oh, I mean, I was so desperate. It was 2008 at the point that I was trying to pivot into writing. And so it wasn't as though jobs were exactly easy to come by because the economy had just imploded. And I was newly married and freshly unemployed and just, really at sea. And so that year was in some ways sort of a lost year. I was just at home. And my husband finally said to me, "I know you've been working on a novel. I know you have a novel on your door. Why don't you finish it? This is the prime opportunity to do that. Nobody's going to hire you right now." And so I would work on that in between still applying for things. So that was, the sort of just deciding to throw caution to the winds, like, yes, I'm going to work on this thing, even though it's probably just going to go back in the drawer when it's done. The other thing that I did was at that point, I accepted a gig as a blogger for an MTV news site called Hollywood Crush, where I was paid $15 a post to write about young Hollywood gossip and news. And it was just basically, at this point, it was 2009. So it was all Twilight all the time. And that was a moment where I was like, what am I doing with my life? I was so much older at that point than everybody I worked with, even back then. And I just kind of had to say, well, at least I'm getting paid, and it is MTV, and maybe it will turn into something. And this was one of the times when I got very lucky because they eventually folded all the blogs and shuttered them, and they went away. But two people who had been employed within that network got brought over to MTV News as reporters, and I was one of them. So that was how the start of my journalism career worked out.
Thanks to Twilight.
Yes, I owe really everything to Twilight.
Twilight, as so many writers do. Well, I won't ask you if you're Team Edward or Team Jacob. We don't have time to get into controversy on this show.
I mean, I think people have been murdered over less.
I know, yeah. Well, that is such a fascinating story. So you switch over to journalism at that point. You've got a novel in your desk. What was the process of getting your agent like? How did that work out?
So I had come out of publishing, as a publicist, and as a result, I had some connections still to the publishing world. So I ended up getting my book deal by managing to get my novel in front of somebody within, it was Dutton Juvenile at the time. And so I had the book deal first. And once you have a book deal in hand, it's not too hard to go and find an agent. I approached the one person who had ever expressed an interest in my writing back when I was querying, which I did just briefly. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I just went back to him and said, "Hey, now I have a book deal, but I am still seeking representation." And he told me that he wasn't taking people on at that point, but he put me in touch with a colleague of his, and she and I have been together ever since.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Yeah, the book deal, if you go that, if you end up getting lucky enough to get that first, yeah, the agent is quick to follow. Not always, but most of the time. So that's really incredible. And you've just been writing ever since. Amazing.
Yeah. Occasionally crying in the fetal position, but mostly writing.
I think that counts as writing, to be honest. I mean, I
Yes.
think when you look at the official job description of a writer, it's in the bullet points.
Yes, that is like the background work.
Right. Yeah. You have to get a good amount of crying in the fetal position to progress, I think. Do you still do journalism or are you writing full time?
I thought you were going to say, "Do you still cry in the fetal position?" And it's like, baby, every day. Some people do morning pages. I do morning crying on the floor of my
I
closet. No,
just assumed.
I kid, and that's just more like every Tuesday night. No, I am still. I've managed to keep a foot in each world, and it's been really wonderful because at this point, I moved from writing entertainment news to being a culture writer and an essayist. And what I love about this work is that I still spend a lot of time reading and watching television, which I love to do, and seeing movies and thinking about how they intersect with the world we live in. I think storytelling is just such a powerful thing. And I love thinking about it in a kind of a galaxy-brained way. And so when I am working as a journalist, it's just another form of storytelling, but it's a different form of storytelling. And so what I get to do in that work is to approach a lot of the same questions that I approach as a novelist, just from a different angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. Do you find, you know, that that your process changes? I mean, you're looking at story from different angles, but I'm curious, you know, like, do you tend to plot your novels? And, you know, how does that work? And then how does looking at the different angles sort of shape the final product?
So I do plot. I think it's very important as a mystery and thriller writer, which is, it's basically like constructing a puzzle box. And I think for me, if I don't know what the pieces of the box look like in advance, then I'm not going to build it very effectively. I know that there are people who pants their thrillers, and I am absolutely in awe of them. Could not do that.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about the way that these two things intersect. You know, as a journalist, what I'm doing is I am finding other people's stories, and I am really led by a quest to understand the world. I want to understand what is true. I want to be able to see and describe accurately the meaning of what I'm seeing. And so that is obviously a different muscle from playing around in a world that's purely of my own creation. But I do stumble across things in my work as a journalist and as an essayist that I think do help me understand the sort of fundamental questions that also drive every good novel, which is, who are we to each other? Why do we do this to each other? Why do we treat each other the way we do? And it's helped me understand human nature in ways that I think, you know, pure imagination wouldn't necessarily always serve.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, I can see that, having read your latest book, How to Survive in the Woods, which I devoured, by the way. I could not put it down.
I'm thrilled to hear that.
Yeah, it was. I actually even texted a couple friends, forgetting that I have the privilege of reading books early. I was like, you have to get this book, and sold it so much. And then one of them was like, why would you do that to me?
Until
March. Anyway, I digress.
It'll be here before she knows it.
I know.
Just sit tight.
But I can see how, you know, sort of those layers would come out in being informed, like sort of by exploring those deeper things. Where did your idea for this book come from?
So it was a few different threads pulling together. The very first thing is that I was hiking on the Appalachian Trail with my, I'm going to say little brother, even though he's 38 years old and 6'3", but he will always be little to me. And he and I often talk about my ideas when they're really in their infancy, like the first spark of a thing. I'll discuss it with him if I think that it might make a good story. And in this case, we weren't talking because we were hiking on this fairly treacherous stretch within the 100-mile wilderness. It's actually the same stretch that they hike in the book. We were just doing it as a day hike because I don't sleep on the ground. that's my greatest character flaw.
It's a good rule to have, I think.
Yes. And so we hiked up to the barren ledges and to Cloud Pond Lean To, and then just a little further on to the peak of Barren Mountain, which, you know, unless you're familiar with this part of the world, you're listening to me and you're saying, what the hell is this? Why is she talking about this? But anyway, the point is that this was a somewhat treacherous hike. There are places where you can lose your footing. And my brother did lose his footing and just kind of pinwheeled wildly towards this ledge. And stopped himself short with a couple hands on a tree, and a jagged pointed branch about 2 inches away from penetrating his eyeball.
Oh my God.
And he looked back at me and he said, there are a lot of really stupid ways to kill yourself out here. And I said, yeah, or to kill somebody else and make it look like an accident. And that was the spark. And then the second piece was this movie from the 1950s. It's French and it's called Les Diaboliques. And I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't. I love the title.
Yeah, I mean, now that you've read the book, if you see the movie, you'll see that there is a certain amount of shared DNA there. And I don't want to spoil anything, so I will just say the premise of this movie is there are two women. One is the owner of a school. The other is a teacher at the school. The owner of the school is married to the headmaster. The teacher is having an affair with him. And he's a real son of a bitch. And the two women eventually get together. They're friends or friendly. They're sort of, you know, they've had a relationship formed in the trenches of being involved with this absolute bastard. Yeah. And they decide, you know what, this guy sucks. We need to do something about it. And, you know, it is a thriller. Things unfold from there. I won't say any more, but I was always intrigued by the premise of a wife and a mistress teaming up to get even with a real jerk of a guy. And the idea of setting that in a contemporary setting and putting it on the Appalachian Trail, putting it in the wilderness, because as a thriller writer, the one thing you're always trying to do is get rid of people's phones. Like, mm-hmm. where can I put them where they won't have phones or their phones won't work? So this was, you know, this was the setting that I'd chosen to explore that. So that was the second thing. And then the third thing was just that I really wanted to explore what, and this is something I approach often in my journalism as well, just the question of how we come to identify often as survivors, but in a way that involves making the worst thing that ever happened to us central to our lives and to our identities. I think that's a very interesting thing that happens now, and that's something that women are especially encouraged to do. And I don't know that it's necessarily always healthy for us, but I do think it's interesting, and I really enjoyed being able to kind of explore the question of that and the contours of it in a fictional setting.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that, you know, and again, without getting into spoilers.
Yes, tricky, because they start off right away. They're the first twist.
But Emma, in particular, you know, one of the reasons that I devoured the book was because she is probably one of the most complicated women that, you know, I've read, at least lately, in a really interesting way. Like, she never does or says what you sort of expect. But mm-hmm. then it's, you know, it's, she really does capture that surprising yet inevitable. But I really, really enjoyed reading that about her. And so I was kind of curious, and I think you've touched on it a little bit. I'm sure that asking these questions and thinking about things the way you do with journalism, but what goes into for you creating a character like that? Like, what was important for you to have her embody or to be, or to say?
So this was one of the areas in which I was sort of mapping onto this existing storyline with existing characters. You know, you have the wife, the mistress, and the jerk husband. Mm-hmm. In Diabolique, you know, this is what also a place where I had to kind of play with it to figure out how could I make this work in a contemporary setting, because the thing about the wife character in that movie, it is kind of dated. She's super fragile. She's got a weak heart, and everyone knows this about her. And it's the kind of thing nobody would really talk about a woman that way today. Right. I mean, you know, you certainly wouldn't admire a woman like that. She wouldn't be desirable. But it got me thinking about the way that the appearance of fragility can be in certain ways not a projection of strength, but a way that we kind of create a facade that keeps people from knowing who we really are. You know, to be able to play the wounded bird is very effective. And there is comfort in that. And this was something that I was very interested in exploring for Emma, because it's something that's very much the opposite of my own personality. That she has retreated from the idea of herself as a resilient person because she's decided that there's such a thing as being too resilient, that, you know, so resilient that you become maybe predatory, that you can't trust yourself, that your instincts are all wrong. And so she retreats into this sort of learned helplessness where she allows herself to be bullied. You know, she intentionally chooses to marry somebody very controlling, very abusive. And she does that in part because she likes that he wants to be in control. And so that was one of the kind of key things, you know, thinking about survival, thinking about strength, thinking about the different forms that strength takes, mm-hmm. And the different ways that we kind of process our hardships and our, I don't really like the word trauma, but in some cases it's, you know, it's accurate.
It's appropriate.
You know, that, yes. And, you know, to think about that in the context of fiction, you know, to build a person around that idea, as opposed to kind of chasing a story down to the end of some rabbit hole, was really interesting and challenging in a fun way.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, I think, you know, there's always a risk when you're creating a character that complex. You know, there's like the likability factor, right? Because we're with Emma the whole time, right? Like we are with it, with her. And so, you know, for the reader, you know, striking that balance of allowing the reader to identify with her. And like you said, maybe it's an opposite thing. I think is really, you know, a compelling thing to do. Did you find that it was like any parts of any of the characters, kind of creating them, were easier or more difficult than others?
It was hard to create a villain who wasn't so villainous that, like, from the second you met him, you just wanted him to die. You know, it's always tricky to write a bad man whose appeal is still visible on the page, you know, that's still relatable to the reader, which is something I hope that I pulled off here. You know, I guess, you know, you'll have to tell me. And then in terms of what else was challenging, I mean, getting inside Emma's head again, because, you know, she's a very different person than I am. But when it comes to the women characters that I write, especially my protagonists, I think that the great challenge, and it's something that I really relish because it is hard to do, but it's very satisfying to pull it off, is to create a person who you feel invested in, who you are interested in reading about, and who you feel you understand, even if you don't like her. I don't need Emma to be liked. And I think, you know, she's not necessarily very likable. And yet, you know, at least if you understand why she does what she does, that's sort of all you can really ask for.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I do think sometimes we want our characters to be likable too much, and sort of understandable is a much, I don't know if it's an easier goal, but I think it's a better goal, particularly in thrillers, I think. You know, what, if anything, and I don't know if you write, you know, with this in mind, but do you hope your readers take away from your work?
Oh, I just hope they're entertained as hell. That's all I really want.
Well, that's a good answer. I mean, yeah, we always want that. So I want to go back a little bit just to kind of your writing process. With the plotting, and you know, you're plotting this out and you've got these complex layers. Do you, while you're you know, like, are you kind of doing like the main story beats? I guess what I'm asking is, how elaborate does that go into? Because as we've been talking, I just kind of keep thinking about, you know, sort of the books and the surprises and the twists and turns it takes. And so I was kind of curious, just kind of more about your plotting process, and how detailed you go.
Yeah. So what I like to do is I will create something that I call a plot map, which is a loose narrative summary, scene by scene, which ends up being basically chapter by chapter of the story as I envision it unfolding. And it's a kind of absolute jumbled mess. It's nothing as formal as an outline or as organized. It's just, here's what's going to happen. I'll include, you know, if there's a line that I want someone to say, sometimes I'll write a little snippet of dialogue that I know is going to go into this moment, something that pushes the characters forward, or I'll make a note to myself that this person is experiencing this. I need to like drop in this red herring. But once I have this very loose framework, there's a lot of room within that structure to be inventive, and sometimes for the characters to surprise me, or you know, to figure something out as I'm going. In this case, you know, this is something that I don't want to talk about in detail because it would be a spoiler. But there is something about the relationship between two of the characters that I learned about. As I was going, I was reading up on the backstory of the film Diabolique because I wanted to understand how that was put together and, you know, what parts of that story was I going to kind of recycle, which were I going to discard, what, you know, what was too dated, what could be, you know, kicked up a notch. And in the course of doing that, as I was researching the original story, it was, so the film, I can't remember who directed it. God, I used to know, but it was based on a novel, and I discovered that there was something within the novel that had been discarded for the film. And I thought to myself, oh God, that's juicy. That would elevate this story to a new place in a new way if I bring it back in. And so I did. Oh, you probably know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. I know. Is that tantalizing? Hopefully everyone's really excited now. Yeah, that is actually really interesting. I guess the research makes sense, you know, given, you know, the journalism, but also, do you typically, sort of, I guess the nature of this novel required some research because it's based on that movie. Does that happen a lot with your books and your plot? Like, or is this the first time that you sort of tackled, like, I don't want to say a retelling, but a retelling-ish approach?
It's more of a jumping off point. I mean, you know, there's a point at which if you watch the movie, you'll notice that there are certain beats in common in the plot, in terms of how it unfolds. And then there's also a point at which it just goes completely off the rails and becomes an entirely new thing, which I think is probably, I mean, that's my preferred approach. I don't really want to write pastiche. I don't want to write a straight up reboot. I want to do my own thing. But I really like this, just the premise of the jumping off point. And so, you know, I watched the movie a few times. I mean, when I was writing, I'm trying to think, so my second most recent book, No One Will Miss Her, which I don't know if you've read, but that was heavily influenced by a song by the Mountain Goats, whose lyrics I thought were really interesting. Like they told such a vivid story. And so I started using those to kind of like frame the story. So I listened to that song a bajillion times. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, figuring out, you know, how do I extrapolate from whatever it is, but sort of, you know, if I have a piece of source material that I'm using is part of it. But there's also the research of, I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to survivalists, preppers. There's, you know, a heavy element of that. I talked to people who are really experienced outdoorsmen. I talked to a climbing expert for one scene. You know, there's so much that goes into it. And then there was just, I mean, I spent a lot of time in the woods.
Yeah. I imagine it felt very vivid, but I think that that's very interesting. I think sometimes for me, the research is sometimes like more interesting, you know, than like what happens, just because it's, I think that may be the case for a lot of writers. We like a good rabbit hole.
Yes.
Able to dive deep on that.
Absolutely. I mean, my historical kind of romantic mystery, You Must Remember This, I wrote it during the pandemic. And so I couldn't really, I mean, nobody could go anywhere. Mm-hmm. But that was me channeling my recreational billowing habit into a piece of storytelling, because I was getting obsessed with all of like these huge 30 bedroom mansions on the coast of Maine. And I was like, hey, you know, now I can buy one of these and it'll be a tax write-off.
Right. I set up a nice little writing workshop and have a little business, a writing
Yeah,
breakfast. There you
little
go.
murder on the side.
Fictionally, of course.
That's the, I mean, that's really the best kind because you can just do it over and over again.
I have just really enjoyed talking to you. And we
Oh.
like to always end our show on the same question, which is, what's one piece of advice you would give new or aspiring writers?
Oh God, I'm gonna be so cliche here, but one sentence at a time, man. You just
Yeah.
write one sentence at a time.
I think that's great. Sometimes it's the classics, right? The oldie but the goodie. Well, thank you again for coming. And if anyone is intrigued, How to Survive in the Woods is out today.
Thank you so much for having me.
She was so much fun to talk to. She's so funny. But one of the things I really liked is how she sort of like her path to publishing, I feel like, was like every wrong road along the way. Like she started doing publicity bad. And I know we talk about like missteps in writing, usually in terms of like mistakes you made in your writing or like rejections and things like that. But I was kind of curious, like how failure, quote unquote, failure in other jobs might lead to writing, and like what lessons could be learned there, like if writers can look at that. What do you guys think of? What have your missteps been?
I mean, Lee Child was fired from his job and started writing. Does that count?
Probably. I mean, maybe, yeah.
There's a lot of people I think that where writing is like always the fallback, right? Because
Yeah.
it starts as a hobby for pretty much everybody. And then all of a sudden somebody pulls the rug out from under you, and then you kind of have to do it for real, and it's a sink or swim kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of, this book is basically your taking that the wild, which it is, but also like high intensity survival. And there's a lot of different themes in there. And I kind of thought, like, in an extreme survival situation, what are the odds you would make it? And what situation would increase your odds to survive?
Well, do you guys go on like hikes or these kind of things, like
Yeah.
little excursions away
Yeah.
from
Yeah.
civilization?
Yeah.
Like, do you bring anything with you? Do you bring water? Do you bring anything that would help you survive
It,
if something goes sideways?
if I'm going to be out like really far out, I tend to have a pack with water and food, but also I've learned to carry little things. I always have a pocket knife. I always have like I try to always have my phone. If these days you have like a satellite connection for the phone, like there's an emergency thing in most iPhones, for example. But things I carry with me is like paracord and duct or yeah, basically duct tape, little things like that. I carry a whole bunch of little stuff when I'm out in the middle of nowhere because I've learned how to use that stuff to survive. But folded up bits of foil, for example. Like you can do anything with aluminum foil. You can make bowls, you can cook stuff in it.
Yeah.
I was listening to you guys all know who Kevin J. Anderson is, right?
Yeah.
So he's notorious for dictating his books, and he likes to go on walks. He lives in Colorado, so he goes up into the mountains and just goes for a walk and dictates his book. Apparently he broke his ankle recently while out on one of these walks. So he had to
Whoa.
get back to his car or his house or whatever his home base was, and I think he said he had to go a mile and a half like after this injury. And if you think about it, like what Kevin just said, that makes perfect sense. And like, if I was, like we were in Costa Rica and we went up in the hills and we went for a hike that was going to be an all day thing, and we brought tons of like that kind of stuff, just in case. But I think it's the one-offs. Like Kevin probably takes this walk every day. He
Yeah.
probably brings nothing with him other than maybe a bottle of water. He might even leave his phone at home because it's a distraction. You know what I mean? So like you're going into that the exact opposite. Like I walked my daughter to school this morning and like she slipped on some ice just walking to school. Like that's how quick
Yeah.
these things go bad.
Right.
Yeah, I guess thinking about it in those terms, like if I think that's actually probably pretty common. I have gone on like little walks. And it's funny because we live like right on the edge of the desert. And so like I have been known to just like, the dogs go down a little dirt path and like suddenly you're, a decent way around the house. And it doesn't feel like the middle of nowhere because obviously like it's not a forest, right? It's just the desert. So you can still see everything. But like if I fell down, you wouldn't be able to see me like from a road or something. And, you know, it's
Right.
the desert. So I guess, yeah, that I didn't think about that. That could be precarious.
Yeah, I think though, when you need to survive, though, you get some instincts or adrenaline that kick in. And depending on your physical shape, I have a friend who is a Marine and told me a story in training, broke his ankle in the first mile of this ridiculous hike that was, I can't remember in my mind, it was like 60 miles, but it might have been somewhere between 20 and 50. But he had to walk the rest of the hike on a broken ankle.
Oh my.
So, because they're like, tough luck. You want to like make it, get up and walk.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, you know, that really just to me was like in survival situations, sometimes you do more than you think you're capable
Yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Look,
don't know.
your best strategy in an emergency situation is to first stop everything, slow down, and
Yeah.
take an assessment of everything that you have with you. Because the first thing that generally happens when you're like an emergency or a survival situation is people kind of freak out and panic, and they start running, in the direction they think will get them back to home or whatever. It's really important to just stop for a minute. This is probably one of the best times to practice like meditative sitting, because if you can just look around, you might actually spot, oh, that's the tree I passed on my way here, so I know that that's the direction I came from. Or if you've broken your ankle or something like that, you can create a splint, or you can wrap it with something you have on you, your belt, the waistband from your underwear. I mean, there's lots of you basically walk around with a lot of stuff you could use to survive, but you have to think outside the box sometimes.
You know, that's actually kind of interesting to think about because, like, essentially what you're talking about is, like, you know, kind of changing your brain away from like that panic, emotional, like reactive, and getting into that prefrontal cortex where you can get into that decision making and all those executive functioning. And I think it's really interesting, especially like this book is a thriller, right? So I guess, you know, an interesting way to look at how to create that tension in writing would be how to not let your character, you know, like the what would have to happen to like keep escalating that emotional reaction,
Yeah.
which she did here. But I guess I've never kind of thought about tension and plot like kind of in that way, like how to keep your character in that emotional reactive state versus like the I'm capable, I can do this, I can problem solve state.
Yeah. I think the most effective thing to do is to kind of let the reader in on what should have happened. Like, you set up that scene where it's like, she found herself in the middle of the woods. She didn't know which way to go, and she panicked and she started running, never realizing had she just turned, in the opposite direction, she was, 100 feet from the path. Let the reader know that that's what's happening, because then that drives up the tension. And the whole time that they're going the wrong way, the reader is practically screaming at the book, like, just turn around, moron. You're only 100 feet from the path.
I think was it JD that mentioned the girl who loved Tom Gordon?
Yeah, that's a
Stephen
great book.
King does that really well, especially in that book.
Yeah,
that's one of my favorites.
That's a good Lost in the Woods
Yeah, it
book,
really
actually.
is, but it really does what you just mentioned, where he sort of lets the reader in on all the missteps that the character takes that the character doesn't know about, but you as the reader do. And yeah, it just, you're like, no.
Yeah.
I mean, they do that in heist novels too, right? They're like, here's our really laid out plan, and then they show how it all goes to crap, you
A
know?
good heist plan unfolding is really fun to read too. Complicated to write, but fun to read.
The most fun ones for when it comes to like heist stories and things like that is where everything kind of comes off like you would have no idea how this happened, and then they do the reveal and it all seems impossible, and then suddenly they do the big reveal, and you're let in on the plan after it's already over,
Yeah,
and that's
that's
when
a
it's
way to do
fun.
it too. Yeah, both
Yeah,
ways are fun.
I love that.
Whether you want your heist to be successful or not, it depends which order you do that in.
A disaster heist or a successful heist. Those are the
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Like if you're telling a story where the heist goes wrong, you give all the details up front.
Yeah.
If you're telling a story where it all went perfectly, you don't give the details till the end.
Yeah.
That's a good
But you maintain the tension that, you know, you're not sure it's not gonna come across, and maybe even make the reader think that it did fail, and then the reveal is that it was successful.
I'm not sure how we got on heist, but there's a show on Netflix called, I think it's Kaleidoscope. And it's like five or six different episodes, and every person that watches it, like, it randomly shows you the episode order. Like there's no particular order you have to watch them in. So like as soon as you load it up, it just assigns an order to you. So you know, your neighbor is going to watch it in a different order than you would. And it's basically a heist that goes wrong, and they give you all the details, but like in these little pieces, but it still works no matter how you watch it. So it's a great series to watch, you know, first as a viewer, but then just go back through as a writer and just look at the stories, look at the clues that they give away in each episode, how they all tie together, you know, why they still work when you move this one from episode two to episode four. It's a masterclass in writing.
Yeah, you've mentioned that before. I just wrote it down because I keep forgetting to watch it. It's on my list now.
I wonder if that would be, you know, as people are exploring, you know, I mean, not to mention Stephen King again, but, you know, they've got that book that he wrote. He co-authored. It's coming out as a newspaper, and like people are doing sort of like different types of publishing. I wonder, you couldn't do that in a physical book. Well, maybe you could, but like, in a random like newsletter, like an ebook or something where it gets delivered in a different, I wonder if that might be something that someone could play with.
Yeah. You can call out different things, like Dan Brown in his latest book, he mentions a YouTube video. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go in real life and you can watch this YouTube video. And it's fun because a lot of people don't actually do it. Like that book sold a lot of copies, but like if you look at the view count, it's not as high as you would expect it to be. And the video itself, I don't want to give anything away, but like it's like 2.5 minutes long. It doesn't seem like it should be because there's not a whole lot happening. So you have to kind of keep it on your screen and just watch the full 2.5 minutes to really understand what it's there for. But it gives you a clue into the story. So it kind of adds a whole other dynamic to the book that wouldn't normally be there.
That is interesting. Like, what's interesting about that to me is the reader probably doesn't even realize that that's a real life thing, because you're just not used to it being.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know Dan well enough to know he wouldn't throw it in the book unless it actually meant something. So I logged in, but I mean, I think a lot of people just glance right over that. You know, it's almost like hearing a 555-1212 phone number or something. Mm-hmm. You ignore it and move on. Yeah.
But that was Greg Hurwitz did that with Orphan X.
Yeah,
that
number with Orphan X.
You can actually call.
They did that in Stranger Things. There was a phone number on like a missing persons poster.
Jane,
and if you called it, it took you to like the Hawkins Police Department or something. And it was like a whole, but it was just like, you'd have to know to like, you know, pause the show on that flyer and like call the number. But that's kind of fun discovering those things.
I'm going to put a number to Domino's in my book and tell people they can order me a pizza.
Perfect.
Okay.
All right. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got J.R. Thornton coming on. J.R. graduated from Harvard and later earned an MA at the University in Beijing. He currently lives in Italy and works at AC Milan. His second novel is called Lucian. It's coming out through Harper on March 17th. So, J.R. Thornton.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.